Welcome to this podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. You're on Sunday Nights on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Coming up in just a moment, Noel Debien and George Weigel, Catholic historian and intellectual and a controversialist, a willing controversialist in Catholic culture. But first, a piece of music selected by Professor Weigel.
Chapontia Te Deum Laudamus, praise to God, major hymn of the church, their choice of our guest in this hour, Dr. George Weigel, who of course is the biographer of John Paul II. Dr. George Weigel, the first question I'd really like to ask you is, how much time did you spend with John Paul? How much access did you have?
Over the course of 14 years of lengthy conversation, I would say it's in the dozens and dozens of hours. While I was preparing Witness to Hope, the first volume of my biography of the Pope, I would see him often once a month for two and a half hours over lunch or dinner, during which we worked through a series of questions I had prepared for him. After Witness to Hope was published in 1999, our conversation continued until his death. I mean, the last time I saw John Paul II was 6 weeks before his last hospitalization. So if you added it all up, we're probably talking about 7 or 8 dozen hours of one-on-one conversation.
How did that eventuate? I mean, it's fascinating to me as a normal journalist that one gets access to John Paul II. What was the string of events that led you to have a personal relationship and, in fact, end up with a biography which, while not officially approved, is as close as it gets to an officially approved biography of a pope?
Well, it's not officially approved because the Pope never, of course, he never saw the second volume, which was published 5 years after his death. And the first time he saw word of the first was when I handed him the finished book at Castel Gandolfo on September 12th, 1999. That was part of our understanding. This had to be my responsibility, and that gives you an insight into him. He understood that my telling of his story had to be what I learned, not what he or others would have me say. How did this happen? I had been writing about John Paul II from virtually the first 2 or 3 months of the pontificate. I think over the course of the 1980s, he had a sense that I was one of those who were interpreting him in the American media and academic context in a way that he thought made sense. Then in 1991, I did the research on the role of the church in the collapse of European communism that led to my 1992 book, The Final Revolution, which I think was the first book in any language to put the Catholic Church and John Paul II at the center of that drama. And he read that book in page proofs through the mediation of a mutual Italian friend. And that was the beginning of our serious conversation. I think he was taken with The Final Revolution, not because I made him the star, but because I was advancing a view of the way history works that was very close to his own, namely that history works through culture and conscience and moral conviction, not simply through politics and economics and the clash of institutional interests. That was the beginning of our personal conversation, our intense personal conversation. In 1995, I had the idea that I should write his biography. There had been previous efforts at this. They were universally bad, if I may say. And I thought I could do this. I knew the Polish side of the story through the work on the previous book. My own academic training is in philosophy and theology. I knew that you had to take the ideas of this man seriously if you were going to really grapple with his life. And I had had a fair amount of experience at that point at translating, if you will, complicated theological, doctrinal, philosophical matter into a vocabulary that people without specialist training could engage. So I pitched the idea of a full-scale biography to his press guy, Joaquin Navarro-Valls.
Joaquin Navarro-Valls, I just want to interrupt there because we're talking here about the first layman to be press secretary, which tells you again something about the man, and you're dealing with a layman, aren't you?
It tells you a lot about the Pope's respect for professionalism. I mean, Joaquin was a pro. He was the Vaticanista, the Vatican reporter of ABC, a big Barcelona paper. He was also trained as a psychiatrist, which he used to joke gave him a great professional background for dealing with the Vatican press corps. What also made him a great White House press secretary, I might say. In any event, I was having dinner with John Paul II in early December 1995, and this question of a biography came up. And he made it clear that he thought it would be a good idea if I took a run at this. I then explored over the next few months the ground rules. And one of the things I said is a point we already touched on, and that is, I said to him, Holy Father, you can't see a word of this until I hand you the finished product. To which he said, well, that's obvious. Now let's talk about something interesting. So that gives you another insight into his sense of how people have to live out their vocational responsibilities.
You were trusted, however. There was a judgment made, I think, on the part of John Paul II that he trusted you to do this and he didn't need to police it. Part of the conclusion you come to here is to attribute a great deal of, I think, significance to his role in the collapse of world communism.
When I first advanced that proposal in 1992 in the book The Final Revolution, it was regarded as wildly speculative and perhaps even a little weird. I mean, everyone knew that Gorbachev was the key guy here. Well, 3 years ago, the premier historian of the Cold War in the United States, John Lewis Gaddis at Yale, wrote a new history of the Cold War, which includes the very satisfying sentence, from my point of view, the beginning of the end of European communism came on June 2nd, 1979, when John Paul II got off the plane in Warsaw. John Gaddis is a friend. He invited me up to Yale to give a public lecture and then address their grand strategy seminar. And after his explaining that I had been on to this early, I could not resist beginning the lecture by saying, as I was trying to tell you 10 years ago.
Let's unpack that a little bit, because there are you describe a lot of this in the book, the actual conversations, the background of the man. So let's just start with the background of the man. Before communism, let's start with the war, and the war and the effects of the war on Karol Wojtyła, because this was pretty traumatic, not only for Poland, but for him.
It was the crucible in which the man who became John Paul II was formed. I'm often asked, what did you learn about the Pope in the course of this, since I obviously knew some things before getting to work. And one answer is, I learned the absolutely central role of his experience of the Second World War, both in terms of his vocational discernment and in his sense of human possibility and the role of the church in defending the dignity of the human person, which he believed he could best do through the vocation of the Catholic priesthood. It was an unbelievable experience, largely ununderstood in the West. The Nazi occupation of Poland was brutal in the last extreme. Its long-term intent was to starve and work the Poles into non-existence. The short-term intent was to make them into slave laborers for the greater glory of the Thousand-Year Reich. That was the experience in which this sensitive, literarily acute, very intelligent, but very friendly and capable young man lived for 5.5 years. As one of his classmates put it to me, it was not a question of not knowing whether you would be alive at Christmas or at Easter or on your next birthday. It was a question of not knowing whether you would be alive tomorrow morning. And to live that way for 5.5 years was a formative experience for John Paul II.
You note in your book he was surrounded by anti-Semitism. Even Cardinal Hollande, an anti-Semite. Lolek, as he was called, himself became a refugee at one point. His father died during the war, so he became an orphan. He saw many, many deaths. We're talking about a young man who saw death. These are very formative experiences, I think.
I try to describe this to audiences sometime as saying that experience was analogous to all of those harsh forces that we know are at work underneath the surface of the earth. Sometimes those great geological, gaseous, whatever, forces explode out in volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, tsunamis, and cause great damage. That's what those pressures do. But something else forms within those pressures, and that is a diamond. Diamonds are formed in the crust and beneath the crust of the earth by those fantastic pressures. Diamonds are clear and diamonds are hard. Diamonds can reflect light in a way that nothing else is capable of doing. Diamonds can cut through substances that people think are impermeable, like the Berlin Wall. That's what happened to Karol Wojtyła during the Second World War. He became a kind of diamond.
He came through the war. He lived. His seminary studies had begun. They were irregular seminary studies, of course, not unlike Pius XII, two popes who had irregular seminary formations. And then communism took over. And then again you talk also his experience of communism and Marxism is very formative on this man.
Well, the communist project in Poland was one of usurpation rather than extermination. If the Nazi project was extermination over the long haul, the communist project was to usurp Polish culture, to rewrite the history, to rewrite the literature, to rewrite the national identity, to remake Poles into new Soviet men and women. This was, of course, completely offensive to this young priest who was so deeply formed by the history and literature of Poland that he chose to celebrate his first three masses as a priest in a small crypt in Wawel Cathedral in Krakow, where some of the great heroes of Polish history are buried, and said that he did that in order to express his gratitude to those who had formed him in this culture and in this history. So that was the battle. The battle was for the soul and mind of a country. And he was singularly well equipped to fight along that line of struggle. He knew the history and the culture better. He spoke the language more eloquently. And because he was a Catholic priest, he was a representative of that institution that throughout Polish history, but most particularly during the Second World War and the communist period, was the safe deposit box, if you will, of Polish national identity. This is where the crown jewels of Polish memory and national aspiration were kept. They were kept by the Catholic Church. So it makes for a very potent, if you'll pardon the word, cocktail here, which he then deployed over some 20 years as a bishop in Poland prior to coming to Rome as pope, and then deployed on a world scale. I once said to John Paul II when he asked me, "What are you learning about me now?" I said, "I'm struck by the fact that virtually everything in your pontificate was previewed in Poland, from World Youth Day to the resistance to communism to the emphasis on lay initiative, marriage and the family, etc. All of this is previewed in Krakow." And he said, "Well, of course, if the Holy Spirit saw fit to bring the Archbishop of Krakow to be the Bishop of Rome, it must mean that there was something in that distinctive Cracovian experience, or more broadly Polish experience, that was of use to the Universal Church. And he had enough confidence in the providential character of his own election that he didn't have to learn how to be Pope. He just brought Krakow with him and then started playing on a global stage.
Interesting you say that, because when I was reading the original book, of course, I was struck by his implementation of the Vatican Council. Now, this was a young bishop who'd been to the Vatican Council. He came back to Krakow, and he engages in a synod, and he actually pulls people in and actually starts implementing a council in a way I can tell you we never saw in Australia.
Or in the United States. I mean, I think the Cracovian implementation of Vatican II was the most thoughtful and comprehensive of any major diocese in the world. And some of the discussion groups that formed in 1966, 1967 are still meeting once a month in 2011, 2012. I mean, that's the enduring power of this. I think Wojtyła saw the council as a spirit-led initiative that was intended to give the church a new burst of Pentecostal and evangelical energy. And he linked the Second Vatican Council very closely to the turn into the third millennium. This was given by God to the church at the end of the second millennium in order to prepare the church for a third millennium of energetic evangelism. Hence the phrase, the new evangelization, which he begins to deploy as Pope in 1992, always linking that to the Second Vatican Council.
I suppose in a time, 2011, when you hear this argument about reform of the reform, is it going backwards? Are they reversing the council? Are we not being true to the council? It struck me in reading this that John Paul himself was there at the council, number one. He then came back to his own diocese and implemented it in a way more thorough than anywhere else seen in the world. And that we're also now currently seeing a pope who was also at the council as emeritus. And there seems to be, some value in noting this.
I think there is value in noting this because it's quite absurd to say that, as some people do, that these two guys who were at the center of the drama of the Second Vatican Council would somehow want to effect a rollback to that which they were seeking to get beyond in the 1960s. However, it is true that with Wojtyła and Ratzinger, we are at the end of an era. The one thing we know for absolute certainty about the next pope is that he will not have been at the Second Vatican Council. This is the end of that line, which I believe goes back to Leo XIII, and in a book that I hope to publish in the next year or two, I'm going to trace a long arc of Catholic reform that begins with Leo XIII in 1878, runs through the Catholic Renaissance of the mid-20th century, cashes out, if you will, in the great drama of Vatican II, which is then given an authoritative interpretation by John Paul II and Benedict XVI, at which point that arc ends and a new era begins. And that era is what I call evangelical Catholicism. It's the end of the Counter-Reformation Church. We're no longer on defense anymore. We're going on offense. We're going out to convert the world. That requires a much more liturgically, sacramentally, theologically integrated church. It requires a great deal of the lay faithful that was not required by Counter-Reformation Catholicism. It requires a social doctrine that can really engage the problems of the 21st century world. But all of the turmoil that one experiences in the church in these past 40 years, I have come to understand as the necessary, in a sense, death throes of the Counter-Reformation and birth pangs of a whole new moment in Catholic history when, in fact, we go back to Galilee and then head back out into the world.
Let's take that as a juncture for a second piece of music you've chosen, a piece of Mozart. Now, why is this significant to you?
Mozart was a God-touched personality. The interpretation of Mozart as a raving Freemason who hated the church simply bumps up into the hard reality of the Ave Verum. No one could write music like that who did not believe in the Holy Eucharist in the way that the church believes in the Holy Eucharist, or so it seems to me.
The Ave Verum, Hail True Body of Mozart, their choice of our guest in this hour, Dr. George Weigel, the biographer of John Paul, Pope John Paul II. Dr. George Weigel, can I ask you, in terms of the experience within Poland, there was a sense that he experienced repression. He understood the worst side of human nature, and he withstood that. Now, how has that shaped his approach to deal with the world that he came to become Pope of?
I don't think that Wojtyła came to the papacy on October 16, 1978, with the idea that he was the providentially appointed instrument for ending the mid-20th century totalitarianisms that had made a slaughterhouse of Europe and a prison of what was not slaughtered. I do think after that epic first visit to Poland in June 1979, 9 days on which the history of the 20th century pivoted in a fundamental way, that he discerned that the communist emperor had far fewer clothes than anyone had imagined, and that new forms of resistance to this oppression were possible. And, of course, he was vindicated in that with the rise of the Solidarity Movement 14 months later. And in a country that was riven by divisions, particularly between educated and less educated people, it brought everybody together in one mass movement of national self-affirmation that at its height had a formal membership of one-third of the country. Mm. This was unimaginable on October 16, 1978, but he was the trigger for all of that. His great friend, Father Joseph Tischner, who died in 1999, said, once described Solidarity as a great forest planted by awakened consciences. Well, the guy who awoke the consciences was John Paul II. And he did it by not talking about politics and economics, but by talking about identity. I mean, during those days, 9 days in June 1979, in 50 variations on the same theme, he would say, "You are not who they say you are. Permit me to remind you who you really are." And if you own that, if you take back the truth of this culture and this national experience, you will find ways to express that that are going to create free space that you can't imagine right now. And that had an immense effect on an extraordinary number of people. Some of it was entirely noble, people saying, "I'm just not going to live the lie of communist society anymore." Some of it was charmingly mixed. There's a wonderful story in Witness to Hope and in the end of the beginning about a miner in Silesia asked why he had come with a million other people to see the Pope in Częstochowa, and he said, "To praise the Mother of God and to spite those bastards." So this was, as all human affairs, a complicated business. But he's the one who bent it in a humane direction. I mean, he could have caused mass rioting, which would have been totally out of character, and he knew, as a prudent and practical man, the bad guys had all the truncheons, not to mention the guns, the water hoses, the cannons, the dogs, and all the rest of it. So new instruments of resistance had to be found, and this idea that Václav Havel, I think a real soulmate of John Paul II, later the president of what was then Czechoslovakia, used to call living in the truth, living as if you were free. That was the weapon that John Paul II deployed, the challenge to live that way, and it proved a weapon that communism had no counter to.
It's fascinating reading the book that during John Paul's time as Bishop of Krakow and during the rise of Solidarity, there were arrests. Father Jerzy was killed, the young priest who was trying at least to help people to remember who they were. The communists also tried to control the appointment of bishops inside Poland. This was a bizarre thing which had happened earlier, I know, but there was an attempt to control it. Now, I'd just like to ask you to contrast that or to parallel that with the way then John Paul later on approaches Marxism when it emerges in South America. Liberation theology, South America, Helder Camara, that whole issue that blew up in the 90s. How did he apply his experience coming out of his Polish background to what became quite controversial in dealing with liberation theology?
Well, the first thing to be said about liberation theology is that it was not an indigenous Latin American phenomenon. Liberation theology was invented in faculty lounges at Louvain and Munich and Paris and then exported to Latin America by Latin American graduate students who had studied there. It was part of a kind of general European fascination with trying to find a softer form of Marxism. You remember figures like Roger Garaudy and whatnot in the 60s and 70s. From John Paul II's point of view, the problem with liberation theology is it was based on a false anthropology. It was based on a false notion of the human person. It was based on a false notion of the dynamics of history as basically the exhaust fumes of economic processes. And it turned the church into a partisan actor. I think it's not quite right, as his critics would say, that the Pope wanted the church out of politics. No, the Pope wanted the church in politics understood as the quest for legal and political institutions that recognize the dignity of the human person. But you can't have priests and bishops who on Sunday are presiding at the Eucharist, which is a sign of the unity of the church, acting as partisan political actors, as the Cardinal brothers in Nicaragua and whatnot. There was something fundamentally unserious about liberation theology as a theological project, but it was addressing a serious circumstance, namely that 450 years of Catholic culture had not produced politically and economically responsible regimes throughout Latin America. So the Pope's idea, as I understand it, was to bring the social doctrine of the church, the authentic social doctrine of the church, to bear on those societies and to challenge men like Pinochet in Chile, whom he had a rather significant role in displacing, to recognize that there are such things as inalienable human rights. Pinochet once said to the Pope in 87 that he had to remain in power because people would get it wrong, to which the Pope replied, "The people have a right to their liberties even if they make mistakes with them." And Pinochet later admitted that this had given him pause, and he had to think about this. And, of course, a year and a half after the Pope left Chile, he was ousted in a plebiscite.
Is it fair for me to understand that when the Pope was critiquing the Marxism of Poland and the totalitarian regime of Poland, when the Pope was criticizing liberation theology and the Marxism being used in the analysis of class struggle, that what he was saying in both situations was, you are not understanding the nature of the human person and human society. Is that a fair understanding?
That's exactly right. And you're not understanding how history works. History, as we were discussing a moment ago in John Paul II's view, was not the mere side draft, exhaust fumes of economic processes, which was the Marxist view. I think the Pope was also a deeply committed to nonviolent social change and the kind of juvenile revolutionary fervor that you saw in gangs like the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, I think just struck him as fundamentally unserious and therefore likely to lead to not much good.
So this was a pope who was anti-violence in the end, right at the bottom of it. This was a pope who was anti-violence.
This was a pope who believed that the 20th century ought to have taught the world some lessons in how to resolve conflict without the use of mass violence. Now, he may have overread those possibilities as the 21st century unfolded. I mean, there are some people who are not going to be persuaded by reason or nonviolent resistance, etc. As a man of faith, he had to believe that all of this awfulness between 1914 and 1991 was in service to some nobler end. In a sense, John Paul II brought that whole understanding to a fine point of development when he said at the United Nations in 1995, with reference to the tremendous changes that had taken place in 1989, that we would see, he hoped, that the tears of the 20th century had prepared the ground for a springtime of the human spirit. And that's, I think, what he tried to apply in Latin America, in Africa, in East Asia, where he was quite supportive of the Catholic efforts to bring down the Marcos dictatorship, etc.
These were all political and social movements which were about government, about the human person and human relationships on a social level. But there were also issues within the church he was dealing with, which we touched on before, the implementation of Vatican II, for example. I don't want to leave this interview without asking you about the Dutch Church. Mm. Because the Dutch Church, I know our own cardinal in Sydney, has a concern about this and says this is the one thing I don't want ever to happen in Australia, where you had a church effectively empty out. Would you mind just unpacking, for those who may not be aware of what happened there, what was the problem that occurred that confronted the Pope in Holland?
It was the problem that confronted the church in France and Germany and other parts of Northern Europe, to some degree in North America as well. And that was an effusive embrace of late modernity at just the moment when late modernity was imploding in what we now call 1968. And giving birth to postmodernism and its inability to say that anything is true. The Dutch church embraced late modernity with particular passion and suddenly found itself within 10 years having no congregations, no religious vocations, large numbers of empty institutions, and a country becoming more and more a sandbox of lifestyle libertinism of the most odious sort. And the church had in a sense unmanned itself or disrobed itself for any prophetic capacity to say to the Netherlands, look, legalize drugs and prostitution in one of your capital cities is a sign of the kind of decadence that democracy cannot coexist with.
The fact of the matter was that after Vatican II, that church imploded, didn't it? The bishops were actually at each other's throats, intellectually at least. They weren't physically fighting, but they were in dispute themselves. There was argument about what the council meant, and in fact it did empty out. And I don't know how savable it was, but the Pope tried to save it, didn't he?
He did. And one can never prejudge the work of the Holy Spirit. Maybe the Dutch Church will revive. I think it's probably more likely that the Netherlands will become some sort of Islamic state over the next 50 years. When 50% of the teenagers in Rotterdam and Amsterdam are Muslim, you have some idea of where the country is going. What John Paul II tried to do with the Second Vatican Council is, I believe, to save it from a kind of self-destructive, internecine, inter-Catholic struggle. And the mechanism for that was the extraordinary Synod of 1985, called to mark the 20th anniversary of the conclusion of the Council, which brought bishops together from all over the world, in which Cardinal Ratzinger played a large role, and which produced a coherent account of what the council was about, gave the church a new universal catechism, which became a very important reference point for knowing what's inside and what's outside the family here. And I think gave a kind of a new impetus to what the council was supposed to produce, namely the evangelization of the late modern world and the postmodern world.
Just jumping back to the Dutch church, when he spoke, he gave them a statement of conclusions. Now, this is something that happens, I discovered, more regularly than just the Australian one in 1998, which I think you'd be familiar with, the statement of conclusions. It went off with a bang here because we were criticised for being, I think, too egalitarian as a church, was, I think, one of the terms that we used. Now, there are those who said that this was Rome being authoritarian, and your book argues very much that this was not an authoritarian pope, but an authoritative pope. Now, how do you make your way through something like the statement of conclusions, which made such a hullabaloo here as well?
The real authoritarianism in the Catholic Church, as I have experienced it for the last 40 years, is what I would call progressive authoritarianism. I mean, the imposition with rather ruthless force by dioceses, national conferences of bishops, their staffs, or whatever, of a very narrow so-called progressive interpretation of the church, which, you know, may be an interesting thing to talk about intellectually, but ends up to be pastorally barren, catechetically barren, and religiously barren. What the job of the Bishop of Rome is, as Ratzinger once put it in an essay, the Bishop of Rome is to make sure that the church has the arguments it ought to have. That's what Peter does. Peter makes sure that we're arguing about the right things, not the wrong things. And that boundary-setting function is a very important one. If you want to see what happens when you don't have that kind of an authoritative role, here's what we should be arguing about, not this. Look at the Church of England today. Look at liberal Protestantism throughout the world. These are classic Christian communities who have so attenuated the boundaries that they can't tell you who's in and who's out, and therefore they have no capacity to invite others in.
There's one thing I found quite amusing in your book. You mentioned that Karol Wojtyla was rarely on time.
He was a man of great conversation. He was always doing four or five things at once, and that made him something of a nightmare for those who were responsible to see that he got to the next thing. But, you know, there's another thing that needs to be said about that, and that is that he lived a different kind of time. The rhythm of his day was a rhythm of prayer and liturgy. It wasn't like a calendar or a diary where, you know, 10 o'clock do this, 12 o'clock do that, etc. And if he was lost in prayer at some point, you know, that might explain why he was late for the next thing, or if he was totally engaged with the person with whom he was in conversation. Now, I mean, he knew this about himself, and he knew it made life sometimes difficult for others. So he would joke about it. I mean, he would come 15 minutes late to lunch with his staff in Krakow and say, "The cardinal is not late, your watches are fast."
As a final question on this, because it's such an important aspect of this man, and it does come through your book too, I think. I noticed in 1986 when he was in here in Sydney, he was very close to me, and I noticed that he was reciting something as he went past. He had his hands raised and he was talking to the crowd, but he was praying in front of me, I could see that. And in your book, you mentioned German TV picked up on this, that there was that they realized he was praying. They came in close on his face, and they thought, they noticed this in any case in Germany, that this was a habit of his. This actually was a man of prayer for whom prayer was deeply significant and very much part of his daily life.
If we can borrow a term from nuclear physics, his prayer life was the reactor core of the rest of his life. And in these huge affairs here in Australia, or the, you know, the 1995 World Youth Day in Manila, possibly the largest crowd in human history. He would withdraw into some space inside himself in order to be in conversation with the Lord so that he could then address 5 million people, 7 million people, and remarkably have many of them think he was speaking to them personally. There are an infinity of examples of these enormous public events in Poland where one guy will say to the next guy standing next to him at a papal event while the Pope is speaking, and the other guy makes a remark, and the first guy says, "Shut up, don't you understand? The Pope is talking to me." How can you do that? I mean, it's not just the skills of a man who had once trained for the theater. I mean, it's a man who had gained an enormous human energy by withdrawing into that center of the reactor core of his conversation with God and finding enormous power and strength there.
Dr. George Weigel, thank you very much for your time with the ABC.
Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.